Because if you don't know, you could break the law when you privately transfer your weapon. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke, KOW's Week in Review. How is your gut handling this week's election results? We asked you that on our Facebook page, which is, of course, KOW Public Radio. We will lay open and examine your gut later this morning as we look into this week's news with the guest you'll meet in just a moment. We are live tweeting, as always, so please hop on with us at KUOW. And we're on the phone at 206-685-2526. 685-BLAM. This is radio, right?
Yeah.
But on our panel this week, Essex Porter, Cairo 7, C.R. Douglas, Q13 Fox, Deborah Wong, KOW reporter, and host of In Close on KCTS. This is the best-looking, visually attractive round of guests we've ever
had. And you can say that because nobody can see us right now.
Yes, true enough. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Bill.
How bad a week was it for liberals?
This was not a turnout election in the sense that another door knock would have mattered or another half million would have mattered. It was a wave election.
And that was a Democrat talking, the head of the Democrat Senatorial Campaign Committee talking about a wave election, though it's a little different story here in Washington State. For one thing, voters here expanded gun control. They passed universal background checks and defeated the opposing measure. Gun control advocates called the victory just the beginning of a permanent movement. I asked former State Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, what's next? Assault weapons ban?
No. Look, if you go farther and you start trying to really restrict people's gun rights, you're going to run into the same opposition that you always run into with gun control measures, and it will not pass. And it would be a huge political mistake for Democrats to do that. They have a huge problem right now with rural voters, with blue-collar voters, with white voters. And if they go out there and try and take weapons, which a lot of people in the rural areas use for hunting, actually, I don't, but they're going to lose, and they're going to further limit themselves to just being the party of downtown Seattle.
A huge mistake. Everybody agree?
I think that's a really interesting point. And because the one thing that really struck me the day after the election is, you know, the Seattle Times always publishes these little maps that show where the votes were. And on Initiative 594, as is often the case, there's a little tiny little horseshoe of Puget Sound that voted for heavily for 594. And the rest of the state, with the exception of four counties, voted against it. So, in other words, King County residents voted 75% in favor of universal background checks. But other counties like Stevens and Okanagan voted 64% against. So you do have this, once again, this huge divide between rural Washington and Puget Sound. And it's kind of, it is, in the case of guns, the huge cultural difference in how people see gun rights across the state. It's just a really big divide. And that's something that's disturbing, I think.
Although I never thought that an assault weapons ban was going to be the next step.
Maybe that's the bad example.
Yeah.
What could pass? What other gun control measure?
They laid out in their post-election news conference that they will have a legislative agenda early next month. They weren't specific. Although they did talk about the idea of keeping guns away from juveniles, certainly in the wake of the Murrysville-Pilchuck High School shooting. Even Texas has a law that says adults are responsible when juveniles get guns. So maybe that's the sort of thing that could even pass the legislature, would not necessarily require an initiative.
Listen, they didn't spend $11 million and rack up a 60% margin and then plan on walking away, right? They're going to leverage that into something. I don't think assault weapons ban is next. That is too controversial. But as Essex said, they did lay out some themes, not specifics, just the day after. I think you're going to see them move. This whole campaign was about criminals and all kinds of stuff. I think the conversation's going to move to safety. And I think they are going to present some things to the legislature, kind of leveraging this win by saying, hey, people want something to be done. And there will be things proposed like liability if you store a loaded gun near a child, liability if you're reckless about a gun, perhaps trigger locks, maybe some safety campaigns. The fact of the matter is that most gun violence, most gun deaths are not criminals. there's suicides, and then there are a lot of accidents. So if you want to reduce gun violence, which they certainly want to do, there's a whole other area that isn't about criminals and bad guys. It's about safety and responsibility. And I see that as their next effort with the legislature.
Well, let's talk about the legislature then. The gun control activist Sandy Brown from the Washington-based Center for Gun Responsibility reminded us that the Washington State Legislature had the chance to adopt this same measure, this background check measure, last year.
The legislature should have adopted this. And the place where it's best to make laws for the people of the state of Washington is in the legislature. And it's only when the legislature fails to act that the people have to take the lead then.
So if lawmakers didn't even expand background checks when they could have last year, and now, the if anything, the legislature is more Republican than it was, why would they support anything more than what?
It depends on what it is. It depends on whether it's perceived as an intrusion on your personal space. I would say even trigger locks are going to be perceived as government telling me what to do with my constitutionally right and my gun. But something like my neighbor has to keep guns away from kids, you know, responsible gun owners are not nearly as likely to object to that. And then those legislators could support something like that.
In fact, on the record, coming up at noon, we're going to talk to a state rep who's going to reintroduce a safe storage law. Before we leave the legislature, knowing how much support that there is, at least especially in the Puget Sound area, for expanded background checks now, is it fair, all this criticism? People have been calling lawmakers a bunch of spineless, knock-kneed, lily-livered, chicken-hearted fraidy cats. Is that fair for what they didn't do last year?
Well, I mean, in some ways, yes. I mean, listen, they were scared that the public wasn't on their side. And look, at the public was on their side by 60%. So I think that's what gives them the opening, at least I'm sure that's what they're going to argue, gives them the opening to go to the legislature and reopen the conversation, if you will. Because I think with this six, you know, it's sort of like Imanism, right? He takes these big plebiscites and sort of uses them as leverage for kind of your next thing. And that's what they're going to do here. They're not just going to sit and be content with a 60% vote. They're going to use it to try and get legislators to do more. And I think they have that opening. It's something that the legislature can't ignore.
And as Deb points out, remember, lawmakers don't run statewide. So a 60% statewide majority doesn't help them. They run in their districts. If you're in Okanagan County and you voted for universal background checks, you're in trouble with the people who decide whether you get to go to the legislature. The statewide outcome doesn't matter.
The Yes on 591 group, this was the failed measure that opposed background checks, they sent out a message saying, thank you. Several incumbent state legislators who supported 594 are losing in key swing district races. Did 591 succeed in bringing pro-gun voters to the polls and beating some Olympia folks? Or is that... You look very skeptical.
No, well, actually, I'm looking puzzled because I didn't look at those numbers. I mean, you know, I was thinking, how could you figure that out? And I guess you could look at the number of total votes for 594 versus the number of total votes for 591 in a specific district and see, you know, if there's a correlation there.
Opponents of 594 warned that it will make criminals out of friends and family who loan each other guns. Does anyone think that that's going to happen and they're going to be proved correct?
I think, there was the issue about transfers. I mean, it had very, very, 594 has very broad language about what constitutes a transfer and very narrow exceptions for example, if a spouse, you know, hand your gun to a spouse or, if somebody's life is in danger, you can hand the gun to somebody. And prosecutors have said, well, you know, we're not going to go after people for handing their gun to somebody on a hunting trip or something. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But it does sort of criminalize a lot of behavior that may be quite routine among gun owners. So
who will be saying I told you so on that issue?
Issue if there's a crime committed with a gun that has been handed to somebody illegally. And then and then that gives prosecutors the right to say, you know, this was an illegal transfer. But it is, you know, it's awkward because in places where there's, you know, where guns are kind of the norm, it raises a lot of questions. What constitutes legal and illegal behavior?
And this is, I think, where you're going to see the legal challenge. I don't think the opponents are necessarily going to fight that it's you know, inappropriate for gun shows or that it's unconstitutional or necessary. It's unconstitutional for online sales. But this whole murky area of transfer, you can transfer your sister, immediate family, but not to your sister-in-law. You know, can you give it to someone hunting? Can you give it not? All kinds of gray areas about what you can and can't do with your gun. They feel like that is ripe for sort of a Second Amendment challenge. And I expect that to happen before this goes into effect December 5th.
Final question. Will this gun background check victory roll across the country into states without Bill Gates and Paul Allen and Steve Ballmer and Nick Hanauer? Yes, they have Michael Bloomberg. He's the one, right? Will this spread like marijuana and same-sex marriage?
And minimum wage.
And minimum wage, perhaps?
The answer is they certainly are trying. I mean, I think you already had people filing in Nevada, Oregon, Colorado could clearly see these. I mean, what you saw here was the start of a movement. Now, whether it succeeds is a different thing. But Michael Bloomberg, Nick Hanauer, the Gateses, the Ballmers, I mean, this was their sort of petri dish, right? They couldn't get the Congress to do background checks after Newtown. So they decided we're going to go state by state, and we're not going to do it the legislatures because it's very hard. The NRA is very good at stopping legislation. They clearly now are not good at stopping widespread statewide votes. So this is now the plan. Go state by state, starting in the friendlier areas like the blue states, and get these background check measures passed and see if you can generate enough to get it at the federal level.
Sierra Douglas, Q13, Essex Porter, Cairo 7, Deborah Wong, KCTS, NKUOW. That's guns. We've got a lot more to talk about on the Week in Review. Don't go away. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. A few minutes ago, we heard tape of my conversation earlier this week with former state Republican Party Chair Chris Vance. I asked him, what's next for gun control? Will there be an assault weapons ban? And our social media producer, Bon Huber. Bon, we're live tweeting the show, and who did we just hear from?
Well, we heard from our friend Chris Vance on Twitter. He wants us to know, to be clear, I think it would be a political mistake for the Democrats to emphasize gun control. I wasn't referring to it as a policy issue.
Political mistake. Okay. Chris Vance listens to this show even when he's not on it. We got C.R. Douglas, Essex Porter, and Deborah Wong. And we are before we move on to another election result, I want to see how much the three of you listen. Do you listen as much as Chris Vance? Because we aired a story this week about something called a soil burrito. Does anybody have any knowledge or guess as to C.R. Douglas? What is a soil burrito?
You got me.
Essex Porter, any idea?
I believe it's some sort of erosion control thing.
Wow.
Deborah, what do you think?
Essex beat me out. I have no idea.
Wow. Let's listen.
A construction crew pours a layer of dirt into what looks like a car-sized piece of burlap. They'll next put down willow branches. It's kind of funny looking now, but if all goes according to plan, those willows will start taking root in the dirt next spring.
You end up in very short order with a matrix of roots that just grab the soil and hold it like crazy.
That's Joe Christensen, a federal restoration biologist who's helped perfect the soil burrito.
A way to keep riverbanks from eroding into the water. What don't you know, Essex Porter?
That reminds me of something I just saw on my Facebook feed about growing lettuce without soil.
Uh-huh.
And you
hydroponically?
It's not even hydroponic. You put seeds on microfleece, and then they take root. The roots go, they break through the microfleece, and then from below, you spray nutrients on the roots. And it's supposed to use 10 times less water than normal agriculture.
Wow. It doesn't matter.
I thought that was amazing.
It doesn't matter how you grow lettuce. It still tastes like grass.
Wow, you have quickly migrated out of my area of expertise.
So we've been telling you what we know about this election. Speaking of a lack of expertise, let's talk about something we don't know, because we don't know what's going to happen to State Initiative 1351 to reduce class sizes. It's now passing by just under 4,500 votes as of last night, so we could be in recount territory. CR, why do you think it is just barely passing? People like smaller classes.
This is the big surprise of the election, especially since just a couple weeks before, this showed 42% margin of victory in an Elway poll and another poll that almost had it that much. So that it's just barely winning, I think it will, because I think as King County votes come in, it'll be enough. My interpretation is that when they asked the question, they basically said, wrote, you know, offered the ballot measure question. Do you want to reduce class size and stuff? But when you go to the voters' pamphlet, this was the most complicated spreadsheet I have ever seen.
CR is leafing through his folder and pulling out.
You get to the description, and a lot of people do rely on voters' pamphlets, and you suddenly had graphs graphs and graphs.
Oh,
that explained how many custodians. So we're not just talking about more teachers. It's not just about reducing class size. It's about custodians. It's about support staff, parent involvement coordinators, guidance counselors, psychologists. This quickly became confusing and frustrating for voters. So
it looks like a horse race betting sheet.
When you just ask the question, which is all Elway did, you get tons of support. When you look at your voters' pamphlet, this looked complicated and it looked bureaucratic. I think that's the reason it's barely winning.
Then there's that other question, do small classes mean that children get a better education? KUOW talked to Robin Lake, director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education.
Smaller class sizes are extremely appealing to all of us, right? We love the idea that our kid will be known and will get the attention that he or she deserves in the classroom.
Right, we love that. But are smaller class sizes worth the cost, and are they the best way to help our kids? Or is there something else, Robin?
The most important intervention that trumps anything else in a classroom is the quality of the teacher. And when parents are asked whether they'd rather have a low class size or a really high-quality teacher, they almost every time choose the high-quality teacher.
Deborah, you're a parent. Class size or teacher quality? What would you pick?
Both.
Okay.
Both. But, I mean, I guess the question is, there's a huge price tag associated with this. So the legislature is going to have to grapple with how to fully fund education. And what does this, I mean, I'm asking you guys, because you guys have been covering this for a long time, what does this mean for the legislature? I mean, if this passes, what do they do?
Well, I don't really know what they'll do, but I have a feeling that they will look at this and they will see what they can do first on the McCleary ruling, which they're in contempt with the Supreme Court on, and see where those two things mesh up, you know, and then they'll have to figure out how to come up with money for the rest of it.
To bring everyone along, this is the state Supreme Court ordering the legislature to pony up more to pay for public education.
I think if this squeaks by, and again, I think it will, you will have the legislature very quickly ignore it. I think they will, and they can't. They actually can't just ignore it. They have to act to suspend it, and I believe they will. Listen, they have a roadmap for how to fund McCleary, and they know what they have to do in this next session. It has to do with accepting more responsibility for teacher salaries. It has to do with all-day kindergarten. It has to do with maintenance supplies. It has to do with lowering class size in K-3. They have all agreed to that. It's just a matter of funding it. This is sort of additive of all that. It complicates things. They don't have the money for it. This will be the first thing suspended in the legislature.
Is it just a majority vote to suspend?
It would take two-thirds. Two-thirds to suspend a citizen initiative in the first 2 years. They've done it before.
In 2000, it looks like there was an initiative 728, which won. It was a class size initiative reduction measure, which won with 72% of the vote. And they repeatedly suspended the measure due to budget shortfalls. I'm reading from the Seattle Times article. And eventually they repealed the law in 2012.
I don't think they suspended 728 the first year out of the gate.
Correct. They didn't. It was they didn't do it with two-thirds. It was they did sort of implement it for a few years. Now, they do not have the money to even do the basics of McCleary, never mind this. They have a huge fight on their hands, right, to just figure out where you come up with the revenue, what you cut, to do some of the basics I talked about. This is why this coalition, the sort of class size reduction coalition, broke down. I mean, a ton of Democrats, certainly several Democrats, were against this. They said, listen, this messes with McCleary. Don't do it to us. People like Jamie Peterson in the 43rd, you know, blue as you can get. Reuven Carlisle in the 36th. I mean, there are a bunch of Democrats that said, this does not work for us. Do not send this to us. And it's going to be easier to suspend if it's only 50.1% as opposed to if this thing passed by 65%, right?
Before we leave improved outcomes here, did the Supreme Court decision get at it was completely about money, or did it have anything to do with improving teacher quality? You ticked off a whole bunch of things, limiting class sizes and paying educators. Was there anything in there about
it
better outcomes otherwise?
Yeah, it does. It does have to do with improving teacher quality as well. One of the things it has to do with is being sure that you are paying enough to attract quality teachers.
Right.
So and then there is the continual training that teachers go through. I mean, the McCleary blueprint, which the legislature wrote and the Supreme Court now wants them to actually implement, is very extensive and very comprehensive.
By the way, I want to disclaim that the educator you heard, Robin, was from the Center on Reinventing Public Education. That is affiliated with the UW-Bothell, which is funded in part by the Gates Foundation. Now, we asked you on Facebook, how are you feeling about the election? And we heard from some listeners. Melanie says, grieving. Why didn't Democrats use the facts about turning the economy around, job growth, Dow Jones over 17,000, healthcare, Bin Laden troop reduction, so much ammunition wasted? Do you think it was just – I feel like these are people who know what they're doing. Do you have any thoughts on whether the Democrats just bungled it?
Well, nationally.
Yeah, nationally.
I think the answer is unequivocally yes, they bungled it. Listen, could there have been a worse night for Democrats? Maybe if they had lost New Hampshire. Otherwise, listen, the Republicans ran the table. So they are probably kicking themselves that they didn't more proactively – push the economy as the reason. You know, that was the top campaign issue. I mean, it really wasn't about Obamacare or immigration. I mean, when you look at the poll, like, it was the economy that really got traction, and the Democrats basically didn't defend it, right?
A lot of states, Democrats didn't show up as well. I mean, they didn't get their people to the polls.
Right.
But, you know, you also have to say for a lot of people, you know, the economy is doing fine. A lot of people around here, the economy is doing great. But that's not true for many others. So, you know, there's kind of a two-tiered recovery going on here.
And maybe the mistake they made nationwide is to think that there was sort of a middle ground, a persuadable voter out there when the electorate was really quite polarized. So they sidelined their best player, President Obama, thinking that, well, he would upset the sort of moderates who might kind of go our way, but they're kind of mad with him, when maybe they should have put him in the game, the entire game, and then rallied the base to get themselves over the top.
Brian says that's what happened when people don't vote. And Sue writes, I want to throw up on someone, can't decide who. KOW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. This week, you're with KUOW reporter and the host of In Close on KCTS, Deborah Wong, C.R. Douglas with Q13 Fox News, Essex Porter, reporter at Cairo 7. And we're talking about the news of the week, a lot of which has to do with the election. A big winner in the election was not on the ballot at all. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray already got his way on a $15 minimum wage in a new park district. This time he told voters to pay for subsidized preschool and more Metro bus service, and they nodded their heads yes. Is he a hypnotist who told the people of Seattle that their eyelids are getting heavy and when he snaps his fingers they'll feel incredibly refreshed and have no memory of dancing in their underwear? Or is there some other secret to his success? How does he do it?
Well, he's a legislative master. I think you've got to just acknowledge that. Listen, he brokered one of the – well, I think it was at that point the largest transportation package in state history, that 9-cent a gallon tax in the mid-2000s. Certainly that gay marriage that sort of was preceded by civil rights and, you know, kind of the gradualism to marriage, he brokered that whole deal. So this guy knows how to build coalitions. He knows how to get people together. He knows the right endorsements to make. So he comes out of this election with two big wins, transit funding and then this pre-K. I will argue that pre-K was the bigger win. I mean, Metro – important, but listen, Metro had won in Seattle in April, right? All he had to do was keep that coalition together. Pre-K was a whole new – keep the coalition together, by the way, with no organized opposition. Pre-K was a new program that had to be explained and defended against huge opposition. I mean, they did not expect the overwhelming amount of money that the unions put in for their own proposition. So that ended up being the bigger hurdle and the bigger achievement, I think, for him this election.
Well, I mean, he started out with taking on the minimum wage. And, you know, everyone sort of scratched their heads and said, how is he going to do this? How is he going to get a $15 minimum wage? There's huge, enormous opposition from the business community and others. And he did it. And the thing that's really interesting
but,
to
but,
me.
But don't play down Councilmember Sawant's.
No, of course. Yeah. I mean, and absolutely. He was not obviously not the only one out there advocating for it. But the thing that was interesting to me is, you know, in Essex, you probably remember this. During the campaign, when he was running for mayor, no one was quite sure exactly what he stood for. And that was Mike McGinn's, you know, thing that he lobbed at Murray all the time. Like, what are you going to do? And Murray would say, I'll build coalitions. I'll bring people together. And it was very sort of murky about, you know, what his agenda was.
Turns out the man had a list.
He had a list. But even the minimum wage, you were at that press conference. He basically, you know, after Shama Sawant had done all of this campaigning about the minimum wage, he sends out a message saying, I'm going to have a press conference. I'm going to talk about the minimum wage. And he sits down and says, I'm for the minimum wage, the $15 minimum wage, with many, many exceptions. And it was seen as this kind of, everyone thought it was a little bit cynical because it had already been on the agenda.
Well, and he
on
was
other
taking,
people's agenda.
During the campaign, he was taking heat from Sawant. He was taking heat on sort of a minimum wage issue in West Seattle with the Whole Foods. He was taking heat from that from Mike McGinn. But I think it would be incorrect to leave the impression that these are not things he does not believe with his heart as well. I think what he realized, and this is where being a master politician is, he realized the timing was right. You know, these are things, you know, he might have wanted to push for, but don't push for losing causes. And all of a sudden, this is a winning cause.
Right, had some momentum.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be interesting how Metro plays out because it could have a couple downsides. The first thing to say about the Metro vote is it was a Seattle-only vote. It breaks for the first time the compact of Metro, which was a countywide, you know, system for years. So suddenly you have one city that's jumping in, deciding we're going to sort of go it alone, and you lose the spirit of cooperation. At least there's a potential of that. And then you get maybe another city, maybe Bellevue, you know, kind of a Richard city that maybe says, okay, we're going to maybe vote ourselves to get a little bit more bus service back. So suddenly you could have what looks like the school levy pattern where some rich districts can afford to do more, poor districts, unincorporated count. And I think we should worry a little bit about the fallout in that respect from this election. And one other thing I'd say, there's a slight danger for the mayor in this win. You know, we're now Seattle, if you will, is a limited partner in Metro. We now own it, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so the mayor is going to be tied to the fate of Metro in a way he wasn't before, right? You could just stand on the sidelines as Metro's problems happened and they didn't have reserves right and got the budgeting wrong. Well, now you're a big partner in Metro, so you're going to be part of the political fate of that county system now that you're the Seattle mayor that's basically invested in it.
C.R. Douglas, Deborah Wong, and Essex Porter figuring out the week's news. I'm Bill Radke. Last week after our windstorm and subsequent mass yard cleanup, I got wound up trying to figure out why people use leaf blowers. Do you get too much exercise? As it is, your doctors advise you to be less physically active. Do you not own a rake? Are they too inexpensive and lightweight for you and practical? Is there not enough carbon monoxide in the air for you? Is that the problem? Or there's too much peace and quiet in the world? You suffer from neighbor napophobia, the disabling fear that someone near you is enjoying his rest? My colleague Guy Nelson says he saw a guy using his leaf blower to blow leaves off of his trees. He was aiming it upward.
That's a good idea.
That's a good idea. So this was last week, and our social media producer, Bon Huberman, said, Bill, will you write that down and we'll post it on Facebook? Hi, Bon.
Hi there.
Anybody respond?
A few people.
Yeah.
Around 200 people.
200 people. Some of them explained to me where rakes fall short.
For example, Ryan says, I can blow leaves off my mulch without blowing the mulch around. Can't do that with a rake.
I'm no Cisco Morris, but why would you blow your leaves off of your mulch? Does anyone know that? Isn't mulch just brown organic material, kind of like leaves? There might actually be leaves in mulch, for all I know.
It looks prettier.
It does? Okay, what Bond, what else did listeners say about leaf blowers?
Well, a different Ryan said, mine is electric and extremely quiet.
Hey, there you go. electric, quiet leaf blowers. Awesome. Problem solved, right?
Well, then Tiffany adds, my neighbor has an electric leaf blower. I cannot stand the pitch of that thing. It's quiet, but so high-pitched as to hurt my head. And he runs that thing for a remarkably long time every day he uses it.
I have never heard that said about a rake. How about this post from the one from Townsend?
Perhaps people have some type of disability that prevents them from raking.
Yes, and that's fair. If you have a condition that makes it painful to pull a rake back and forth, but not to wave a leaf blower back and forth, obviously, I don't want you to suffer. How about the neighbor kid who lives across the street and could be helping you and needs walking around money?
Nia's with you. She says, yes, leaf blowers are hidden job killers and community destroyers. How will we ever get to know our neighbors if my 10-year-old doesn't earn his pocket money helping his neighbors? Instead, kids just feel entitled to money. Long live good old-fashioned work.
Amen. And then Clint had a problem with rakes that I hadn't even considered.
Clint says that awful scraping noise rakes make on concrete elicits my gag reflex.
Anybody else?
I have the same feeling every time I rake. And I've been rake. I have this giant tree that just has been dropping seed pods, like for the thousands of them a day for the last week. And it's the same thing every time. I hate that rake.
Okay, just a couple more here. Some people pointed out leaf blowers are not our biggest problem.
Melanie says the only thing worse is the people who power wash the sidewalk. And Asia adds, I see your leaf blower and raise you a neighbor who vacuums the crevices of concrete in his driveway.
Finally, my favorite answer to my question, my original question, why do you foul the air blowing your leaves around?
Bill says it helps turn dinosaurs into noise.
That wasn't me. That was another Bill. It helps turn dinosaurs into noise. Now I know. We're at a Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Thank you, Bont, for posting it and sharing it. Okay, back at the news. We've got some more election analysis and more coming up on the Week in Review. Okay, I did not realize that needed explaining. So again, Bill's joke was leaf blowers.
A different Bill told us it helps turn dinosaurs into noise.
That means that the gasoline that runs your leaf blower comes from the deceased dinosaurs that have turned into oil, so you're turning them into noise.
Yeah.
And when you have to explain a joke, that's when
it was supposed to be poetic or something. I was thinking of it on a different level.
Think of it for that level. It was poetic. KUOW's Week in Review with Deborah Wong, C.R. Douglas, and Essex Porter. Thank you for tuning in. We're talking about the news, which is in large part the election this week. And our state legislative campaigns, we reported this for months, more expensive than ever this year, right? Partly because of all the money spent by an out-of-state California billionaire. Seriously, though, this hedge funding climate change activist, Tom Steyer, did spend a lot of money here, and it got him what?
Not much. So he put was it about $1 million into?
I think ultimately $1.5 million.
Okay.
Spread around.
Washington Conservation Voters, and they targeted three races. Is that correct?
Major, but I think it was spread to a little, five, I think, was their target.
Okay.
But three especially got most of the money, I think.
And apparently 0 for 3. So
0 for 5.
So the big race was Andy Hill and Matt Eisenhower over in your neck of the woods, CR.
On the east side.
Andy Hill's a state senator who is the main Senate budget writer. Is that correct?
Yep.
And Matt Eisenhower, Democrat, who... So Andy Hill's a Republican. Matt Eisenhower's a Democrat who challenged him. This became the most expensive race in legislative history in Washington state, and in large part not just because of Tom Steyer's money, but a lot of outside money came in, national Republican money, national Democratic money as well. And it looks like Andy Hill is keeping his seat, along with all of the other Republicans that were really largely targeted by outside money this year. So in Steyer's case, it did not work. And the interesting thing is he spent a total of $17 million in the 2012 election nationally. And Sunlight Foundation, which is this organization that advocates open government, took a look at all the outside groups and what their track record in this election was. So out of the $17 million that he personally spent of his money on his committee, Next Gen Climate Action Committee, he had a 32% success rate nationally. So only a third of his candidates that he supported won, or the candidates that he targeted for defeat.
Right. And here is Tom Steyer being asked about to how well his money was spent.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, my gosh. There is no, look, the way that we make social change in the United States is through the political process. And there's no doubt that we heightened this issue incredibly. We built up an incredible base of supporters around the country, and we absolutely surfaced it in a way that's never happened before in elections.
Did he build an incredible base?
Wow. I don't know what world he's on. It doesn't seem like any of that happened in Washington with his money, maybe somewhere else. But
But he sounds no different than the conservative billionaires when they spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get Mitt Romney elected and it doesn't work out. You know, then they say, hey, you know, we got to start and we've got more money where that came from. Hmm.
And I think the context of that comment was that he's saying, you know, the fact that he spent all this money at least brought climate change and brought environmental issues into the theater. At least they were talked about, they were debated.
But that's my question. Was that more appreciated or more loathed by the average voter across America and even in Washington State?
Maybe more ignored, apparently.
Ignored.
Yeah. Right, because that wasn't the biggest issue on their minds.
If you look at the polls here, yeah, I mean, the economy was much more important. Even guns were more important this election. The climate was just way down.
But doesn't that risk resentment when you're trying to spend money on something that's way down on the voters' list of priorities, especially when it's a single state that obviously is not going to stop climate change by itself?
I think Republicans effectively made Steyer part of the conversation, part of a liability, if you will, for Democrats. That money had to be kind of explained. But let's just make it clear. Steyer is interested in climate change. He wants to elect legislators and congressmen who are sympathetic to doing something about climate. That doesn't mean that was the message in every flyer he funded, right? He was just trying to take out Republicans. Now, a couple of the Andy Hill flyers did have to do with climate change, but others were just trying to get him as you know, being for tax loopholes and all that kind of stuff. He was doing everything, throwing kind of everything at the wall. My sense is that I don't know Democrats could have done anything. I mean, Steyer could have spent twice as much and probably the same result would have happened. You have what's going to turn out to be probably a 50-51% voter turnout. The math is brutal for Democrats when you're at that level. At that turnout, we don't even have recorded history in Washington.
He's holding another piece of paper, ladies and gentlemen.
A voter turnout in a midterm that's that low. If it does get above 52, that will rival 1978, where it was 52.48%. Otherwise, I don't have anything before 1958. Voter turnout and engagement was ridiculously low. Democrats cannot win in that environment. It doesn't matter how much they spend and what they do. When a turnout is that low, it's a wider, older, more conservative, richer electorate, and that favors Republicans.
Yeah, the key here is, though.
Just one more thing. Democrats needed basically a 65-70% turnout to even have a chance in some of these districts.
Yeah, and why couldn't they get that? What is it about the Democratic message that lets people just stay home? Why couldn't they get that? Why are Republicans so good at driving a message that be sure that their base voters get to the polls and win the elections? You know, that's the question Democrats have to search their souls to answer. Elections are won not just with money, but with message. And in fact, message can trump money, but you got to have a message.
But you're putting it on the messengers. How do you know it doesn't say more about the voters, the types of voters, and what they're going to react to, what drives them?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that's different and why we are at this sort of multi-decade low in turnout is that we did not have a senator or a governor on the ballot. Governors are in our state elected in presidential years, so we never do in these midterms. But this is the first time since 2002 we didn't have a Senate race. So in 2010, we didn't have a president or governor, but we had Patty Murray running. In 2008 or 2006, rather, you had Maria Cantwell. So those top ticket races generate more interest among the electorate. You get people turning out. It is very tough, no matter how much you throw at some of these small districts, you know, Andy Hill and Eisenhower, it's very tough to generate turnout without big ticket items. And guns was not, you know, got attention, but it was not the lightning rod issue that even pot, gay marriage was to drive people out.
So, CR, going to all mail-in ballots was supposed to be this big spike for turnout. What happened? I mean, why hasn't that worked?
Well, turnout probably would have been 40% if we didn't have all mail. Turnout is better with all mail, but it's not been the panacea you thought. It's not been suddenly that we're at 80% turnout on off-year elections.
You know, every once in a while, you'll see a wacky news headline from Florida or something about a deceased candidate gets elected to office, and it's sort of played for, you know, isn't that weird? It's different when it happens in your community, as it did this week in Federal Way. Democratic State Representative Roger Freeman died of cancer a week before the election deadline. Why was he reelected? Como News asked some voters.
You vote for Roger Freeman?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's passed away.
I did not know that. When did he pass away?
Last week.
Oh.
Or perhaps most voters knew exactly what they were doing. Federal Way Councilman Martin Moore called the vote a testament to how the community felt about Roger Freeman. Moore said people voted with their hearts. If the election returns hold up, the King County and Pierce County councils would get together and jointly choose a Democrat from a slate of nominees picked by Democratic Party activists. That person would serve for 1 year, then voters would elect someone next year to serve the rest of the two-year term. Roger Freeman, the late Roger Freeman's wife, says she believes he's in heaven, looking down and smiling. This is KUOW's Week in Review with C.R. Douglas, Essex Porter, and Deb Wong. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be right back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We have been talking about the elections a lot this hour, and we asked you on Facebook, how is your gut reacting to what happened this week, the Republican sweep? And Sue said, I want to throw up on someone, can't decide who. And our social media producer, Bon Huberman, that prompted what?
Peggy sent us a little fun graphic or sticker on Facebook. It's formatted to look like the classic I voted sticker, but instead it says I vomited.
Nice. We have extra time on our hands this morning. thank you for that. So talking about the national election then, which was such a big Republican victory, one of the results of that is that Washington's U.S. senators lose power, particularly Patty Murray, who chairs the Senate Budget Committee. Why should we care about Patty Murray's power? Anybody?
No, crucial. I mean, if, you know, whether, you know, I the Seattle things are sort of on top of mind, but this goes throughout the state. Veterans hospitals and clinics, she can steer to the state. Money to Sound Transit for light rail, she steers to the state. When the Pentagon is making a decision about where to, what company to choose for an aircraft tanker, you realize there's a very powerful senator who represents Boeing and who looks over your budget. So, yeah, it's a crucial loss for our state. It's not necessarily a crippling loss, but definitely a crucial loss.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, you want, you know, all things being equal, you want your senator to be budget chair, right? I mean, we were all covering last year during those debt showdowns and all those sort of super committees. Well, it was Patty Murray. It was Patty Murray there, right front and center. I mean, she was at the vortex of all those budget negotiations, and our state was sort of helped in the details of a lot of that, and she's not going to be anywhere to be seen, right?
When that spending happens. Yes.
Democrats aren't going to be anywhere to be seen in these negotiations.
Right. And when the money's spent elsewhere, it's pork. But when it's spent in your home state, it's clout.
Good governance.
Exactly.
Good
right.
governance. Yeah. Also, what about our other U.S. senator? You know, we're not talking Senate budget chair, but still. she loses her
Maria
position.
Cantwell has a chairmanship of the Small Business Oversight of the Small Business Administration, I believe. So, you know, that's not – she's not in the same league as Patty Murray. I mean, she hasn't been there as long. It's not as big a position. But, listen, we'll lose that. We're one of only three states that will have no Republican senators.
Right.
So everyone, but I think it's – what is it? New Hampshire and California. So – we will not be in the game.
When I talked with Republicans, they say, you know, remember, they also have a woman in Republican leadership, Kathy McMorris Rodgers out of Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
She is the fourth ranking person in Republican leadership, just as I believe Patty Murray is the fourth ranking person in Senate Democratic leadership. So, you know, now with Republicans having the upper hand, you know, Kathy McMorris Rodgers is in a better position to defend the interests of the state.
What are her interests there? What does she do to defend Washington state interests?
Well, one of the things, you know, she'll be clearly taking a look at what happens with money spent for Hanford cleanup,
mm-hmm.
Which Maria Cantwell especially has worked on. And it'll be, you know, looking to be sure that, you know, that work continues, that, you know, and all of that money doesn't go away. You know, there are things that maybe she hasn't been paying as much attention to. But now, you know, she'll be getting those calls from Western Washington. You know, here we have a port and commerce and goods and produce needs to get to the port. You know, can you help us on this? There'll be things like that.
Speaking of Eastern Washington, there was one congressional race we thought would be close and one that might be close. In South Central Washington, there was the replacing of retiring Congressman Doc Hastings. And we learned what from that, from the Newhouse victory?
Well, we learned that, you know, Newhouse was the sort of anointed Republican establishment candidate, and Clint Didier, the Tea Party favorite. It was fairly close, was it not? What are the latest numbers? Is it?
I'm looking at these numbers.
4 and 5%.
On the narrow side.
Yeah. It's certainly not within recount territory.
Right.
I think it was the defeat of the Tea Party.
Yeah.
Their heyday is over in some respects in Washington. He's tried a couple times, Clint Didier, but this was even in a red part of the state, the sort of, you know, more moderate establishment candidate won. And you could say that was reflected nationally. I mean, listen, in Kentucky with Mitch McConnell, I mean, a lot of these places, there were Tea Party challenges, certainly in the primary to a lot of these people. And the establishment GOP won this year.
Let's talk about a race that you covered for us, Deborah Wong. In the 1st Congressional District, the people did not vote for Pedro. The incumbent, the Democrat, Susan Dilbeny, won. And on election night, Salis talked about the challenges of running a first campaign.
The thing that is hard about running a campaign is two things that I always found difficult. One is I have to go around and brag about myself. You know, I've done this, I've done that, blah, 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 and it's not my nature. The other thing is you have to be asking people for money. You know, it's a lot of money in these races, way too much money in these races.
There's money in politics. This was his first ever run for office of any
kind.
Yeah,
and you know, it was sort of unfortunate. I mean, here's a guy who really didn't want to run initially, and he was drafted by the Republicans to run. Great personal story, you know, Mexican immigrant, computer science professor, distinguished engineer at Microsoft, you know, just has done, you know, incredible things with his life, but and has a sense of humor. I don't know if you could tell from that.
Yeah.
He's the guy who always said, "I am the candidate with the charming accent."
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he did very poorly in the primary and really never recovered from that. He was not a good campaigner. Not a good candidate. He was didn't really articulate his vision very well. Didn't really stick to his talking points. He tended to go off script quite often, and Democrats would sort of pounce on that. Whereas Dilbeny, by contrast, you know, she's been a pretty solid member of Congress. She is an she is a very good campaigner in the sense that she never goes off script. She never says anything that is not part of her talking points. I mean, you could ask her the same question three times and she will give you exactly the answer that she wants to give you, which is incredibly frustrating for a reporter, but is really good for a campaign because she will never make a mistake.
Any other thoughts on DelBene Celis?
Well, I mean, he said it right there. I mean, the reason he didn't do well is because he didn't like to brag about himself and didn't like fundraising. Hello, why are you in politics?
Well, why him then? I mean,
well, and Republicans are kicking themselves. I mean, listen, they had a chance to pick up the seat. A freshman House member is at their most vulnerable right after their first term, right? If they had found someone who was better known, probably had elected office, who was not scared and could raise money and could brag about himself a little bit, they would have had a chance. Listen, look at how red this wave was. Look at how favorable everything was for taking back that swing district. They missed their opportunity because they didn't have a top-tier candidate, and they probably lost it for quite a while. It's going to be very hard in 2016, the presidential year. There's going to be a lot bluer voters out there. DelBene's going to have a much easier time then. At that point, you've been elected three times. You've got your power of incumbency. You really know the district. People know you. I mean, it's very hard now to see how Republicans take this thing back because they didn't this year.
C.R. Douglas, Q13, Fox News political analyst, Essex Porter, Cairo 7, Deborah Wong from KUOW and from In Close on KCTS. Thanks for talking about the news.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Good to have you here this week. And here's sort of a, I guess it was a big news story across the country meets KUOW. The Car Talk co-host Tom Malyatsi died at age 77 this week, and I just want you to know tomorrow his brother Ray is going to host without him, and you can expect humor.
Do two people who don't know what they're talking about know more or less than one person who doesn't know what he's talking about?
Is it? Let me think about this for a minute. What's your opinion?
We'll miss the laugh. Car Talk, Saturday morning, Ray's going to host a special for him. I used to see the Malyatsis at the NPR conferences, and one time Tom told me, he said he figured I drive a Honda Civic, which is exactly what I drove, which just made me sad that I'm, you know, I want to be so much sexier than I actually am, but it's obvious.
I was stunned to learn they're both graduates of MIT.
Yeah, right. Smart guys.
Thanks for coming on, everybody.
Absolutely.
Again, Saturday morning, Car Talk, 9 o'clock. Our producer's Jason Pagano. Thanks for joining us on the Week in Review.